From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made this past winter with the debut of two novels, very different novels, but both selected by Writers and Books for the debut novel series. The authors, Garth Greenwell and Hannah Tennant Moore, are in Rochester. They have some events coming up, and this is always one of the fun conversations of the year, a chance to talk to debut authors who are having success with their work and putting together workshops, readings, discussions, those kind of things. It's our chance to bring them in. Garth Greenwell is the author of What Belongs to You, and Hannah Tennant Moore is the author of Wreck and Order, and they are both in studio. And Garth is he's not a Rochester native, but this was at least home for a little while for you.
That's right, it was.
So you're great to see you back here. When's the last time you were here?
I was here in 2006, so it's been a decade.
Okay, and let our listeners know why you were here.
So I lived here from 1996 to 1998 when I was studying vocal performance at the Eastman School of Music.
Aha, yeah. Very good. Well, it's great to have you here. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for
and
having
Hannah Tennant Moore is not from Rochester. First time.
My first time, yes. So far, my experience has been staying in a very lovely guest house surrounded by trees with a crying baby. So that's Rochester to me. So
I asked Hannah, where are you from? She says, upstate New York. And I'm thinking, and she's like from, I know, like a stone's throw outside New York City. No, I'm kidding. Hudson
well,
Valley.
To New Yorkers, to New York City.
Anything
dwellers,
outside New York City.
I live in upstate New York. But yeah, the Hudson Valley, tiny little town called Germantown.
Well, very good. It's great to have you here. Thank you.
And thank you.
Karen Van Meenen is the coordinator of community reading programs at Writers and Books. Did I do that right?
That's good.
That's the official title. do you typically do, I'm always used to one book for the debut novel, am I wrong? Or maybe one in the fall, one in the spring, but you got two together here.
You're not wrong. We decided to change it up this year and put the two novels together so we could have a conversation that was more literally live and have the two books that speak to each other with the authors behind them.
Great. And so I'm always curious to know how you kind of go through the process and how you choose what you choose. Do these land initially on your desk because of critical acclaim and buzz, or are you going through a different process? How's that work?
I'm looking at reviews. I'm looking at lists. I'm looking at awards. I'm looking at chat rooms. I'm reading a lot of other people's commentary on novels. I read a lot of novels, contemporary novels, a lot of first novels. So it came through that.
We're going to have a chance to talk to the authors individually about their books and their works here, but first let's have Karen let you know how you can meet them and what they have coming up on their schedule here. Go ahead.
We have tomorrow at Nazareth College at 1 o'clock. There is a free event, a reading, and a Q&A and a book signing at the Golisano Academic Center, room 38. And then Friday night, tomorrow night at Writers and Books at 7 o'clock, there'll be a slightly longer reading, Q&A, and then our special event is a discussion of publishing, especially using the experience of two first-time novelists. And Garth, I'll probably talk about the novella that this came from, but technically two first-time novelists talking about that experience. It's always an interesting conversation.
Absolutely, and I think to some degree, I think I'm very curious this hour to kind of work through their experience with the publishing industry, which is a fickle one anyway, and not always an easy one to break through with. And so we'll get there. But again, the books are What Belongs to You and Wreck and Order. Wreck and Order by Hannah Tennant Moore. Just broadly speaking here, does it drive you nuts when people talk about this in light of Eat, Pray, Love? I know you've heard it. And I know you want your own book and its own identity, but I want to get this out of the way because a lot of the reviews sort of invoke that model.
Yeah.
Does that drive you crazy? Or is that a compliment?
I don't really find it to be exactly either. It's more complicated for me than that. I've heard some people describe my book as an anti-Eat, Pray, Love, which
interesting.
Rings true to me. I certainly wasn't consciously dialoguing with that book. I was using the kind of spiritual journey cliche that's become popular in recent years of a privileged, usually young woman who goes to an impoverished country and finds herself. And I wanted to use that in a conscious way as a way of critiquing what I find to be a sort of facile kind of spirituality, which is based more in circumstances and less in an inner experience of change. So the kind of change that I was interested in looking at in Wreck and Order is a much subtler personal transformation that to the outside world might not look like my narrator, Elsie, has changed really at all. But in terms of how it feels to be inside her own life, she actually changes quite a lot. And that doesn't happen so much because she goes to Sri Lanka, which is she goes there because it's a Buddhist country, sort of hoping in a naive way that she'll get really good at meditation and maybe meet people who will help her along her journey. And she does meet a lot of people and develop close connections, but none of them are of the type that she was expecting. She actually finds that the Buddhism that's practiced there is more similar to the way Christianity is practiced in the U.S. It's based more in praying to Lord Buddha to get what you want, which is kind of the opposite of what she was hoping for from Buddhism. So in terms of the eat, pray, love comparison, I'm totally fine with that as a point of conversation. I was more looking at a broader idea of a spiritual journey and how it can happen in ways that you least expect it to happen.
Well, if I could be blunt, because we've talked about memoir on this program, and listeners, this is not to offend anybody. Everybody's different. Everybody has different tastes. I'm not a big Eat, Pray, Love fan for some of the reasons that were just described, that, you know, sort of this privileged person goes somewhere else, finds themselves, has this epiphany, and shares wisdom with the world. Now, listen, I'm oversimplifying, and I'm being unfair, and I get it, and the slings and arrows will come my way, and I deserve that. But what I think Reconorder is a little more gritty and real, I think. It's a little less predictable in that way of, oh, you know, this epiphany happened, and here's how the world works. And I think it, just the Buddhism example that you share is an example of the cliche would be, oh, now I see what real spirituality and centering is, as opposed to a disillusionment that can come and a disappointment. So in any way, I guess I just have some gratitude for saying you may take that model, but it turns it on its ear a little, if that makes sense.
Thank you. That's exactly how I'd like the book to be read.
So. Now, your road to publishing was what here? The publishing world is very easy. Everybody gets in. Whatever you want to write gets published, and everybody sells a lot of books. What was your road in the publishing world?
Well, I first spent many years alone in a room writing a book without any sense that I would ever show it to anybody, that it would ever see the light of day. And then once I had a draft, something I could print out and read, and I went through dozens and dozens of those drafts to the point where I felt confident enough to share it with a few trusted readers. Then I submitted to agents. I met with agents and found an agent that I love, and am very lucky that she understands exactly what I'm trying to do. And fortunately, she connected me with a publisher and an editor who I cannot overstate how grateful I am to my publisher, Hogarth, and my editor, Alexis Washam. She is just brilliant. She's a rare gem in the publishing world from what I've heard from older writers, in that she is a very hands-on editor. We went back and forth about paragraphs and sentences.
Let me just dig into that a little bit here. On the editing side, when you say this is a great editor, do you mean this is the editor that asks the right questions, that challenges you appropriately? You know, do you embrace that? I mean, every writer's a little different with what they're hoping for from an editor. What's a great editor to you?
For me, it's less about editing on a sentence level, mm-hmm. because I'm pretty meticulous about perfecting my sentences as much as I possibly can before I let anybody read what I'm working on. But what Alexis did for the novel was she sent me about 20 pages of questions and just said, if any of these help, explore them. And I think I engaged with all of them. It was quite an extensive list. And so it ended up being, for me, the editing process was mostly additions to the book based on questions that came up for her in the reading process of, could you say a little more about Elsie's father? Could you expand on this scene? So that, to me, is a great editor, somebody who asks questions and dialogues with you about what are you trying to do here.
Your book comes out in the winter, and here you are less than a year later. It's being featured by writers and books. So you're here for, you know, events, and it has write-ups and praise in different major national settings. Is that what you expected at all? If I talked to you a year ago, was this part of the game plan? I mean, did you think this was likely or realistic?
I would say the biggest surprise has been how it feels to have a book exist in the world. Just as a feeling, it's been so much more complicated in every way than I could imagine. There's been better stuff than I imagined, worse stuff than I imagined. And I have had a baby in the interim, so that has certainly derailed me a bit. I think I'm just going to horrify women.
You mean like an actual human being, like a physical?
A tiny human.
I thought you were talking about your book for a second. Okay, so you had your book and then you had a baby.
A real
okay,
human.
Yes, got it. Yes.
And I'll just horrify women the world over and just say that I actually feel like I've become less intelligent since I became a mother. And I'm even worse, kind of okay with it for now. I know my intellectual life is there and waiting for me when I'm ready to go back to it. But for now, I'm kind of making silly faces at my daughter and trying to get her to laugh. So that's been helpful in terms of navigating just the confusions of working on this thing for years alone and then having it suddenly exist in the world and be responded to by all different kinds of people. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. So we'll return to Hannah. And two big themes are Americans abroad in these two books in very different ways. I want to turn to Garth Greenwell. His book is What Belongs to You. And I want to read two different things here to start out, because I mean, the praise is just a tidal wave for this book. I could pick just about, 50 different reviews. Jeff Zuckerman in The New Republic called this the great gay novel for our times. But I want to read also from the New York Times review, because before you pigeonhole or sort of niche this book or feel that that is somehow limiting, this is how the New York Times review opened. Quote, in a controversial 1999 New Yorker review of Alan Hollinghurst's novel The Spell, John Updike summed up common prejudice about gay stories, namely, that they have nothing to interest straight readers. Essentially, Updike is asking, what's the big deal? It's just sex. And I will say this about this novel. I don't know if it's the great gay novel for our times or whatever category you want to put it in. I don't understand anybody who wouldn't feel totally compelled by the characters in this. The protagonist, how do you pronounce the name of it?
Mitko,
okay. So let me just ask Garth how you feel about some of that praise, and specifically the praise I just read.
Well, I mean, thank you very much for what you say. I think when you publish a book like my book, I mean, a question that you get asked a lot is sort of, is this a gay book? Are you a gay writer? Or are you a writer who just happens to be gay? And there is this sense that in some way, if you write a book that is centered on LGBT lives, especially if you write that book in a way that is invested in those lives for their own sake and not sort of trying to translate them or their value for people who might be uncomfortable with those lives, that in some way you're limiting your book or limiting its possible reach. This is a gay book and I am a gay writer. And it's a book that is invested in specific lives and specific communities at specific historical moments and in specific places. And it's because of that the book has whatever universal value it has. I think it's a fundamentally mistaken idea about literature to say that to call a book a gay book or to call a book a black book or to call a book a trans book or whatever is limiting it, because it presumes that there is some kind of human experience that's not marked by the specifics of history and culture, and there's not. Literature, I mean, the reason that literature is, you know, the thing that I've chosen to devote my life to is because it's the best technology we have for communicating the experience of another person's consciousness. It's the best technology we have for communicating what another person's life feels like from the inside. And it does that not by dissolving particularity into some kind of vague universal. I mean, literature achieves a kind of common human value that is translatable across time and culture and all sorts of difference because it roots into the particular. And so, yes, I mean, this is a gay book for gay readers, and therefore it is a book for everybody.
Absolutely. So to close the loop on that, when Zuckerman calls it the great gay novel for our times, which is an incredible statement, by the way. I mean, that is affirmation of your work in an amazing way. But in any sense, do you feel that that is limiting?
I'm so grateful to him for saying that. To me, I hope very much that the book is in conversation with a line of writers that, you know, goes from Proust through Thomas Mann, through Henry James, through Virginia Woolf and Thomas Bernhardt and James Baldwin to Allan Hollinghurst. Those are all queer writers in conversation with each other. They are also writers absolutely at the heart of Western literature and of the achievement of Western literature. So, I mean, it's just the greatest possible honor to think that my book is in that conversation. I would love to believe that that's true.
I mentioned Mitko, who is not the narrator, the protagonist, but our unnamed narrator protagonist meets Mitko and is instantly smitten with Mitko. And as a reader, I think you will too, just in terms of how much personality and complexity comes through in Mitko in just the opening pages. Why don't you set a little bit of the scene for, in the same way that Hannah did for our listeners, in terms of where this novel starts and takes place and what's going on?
Yeah, I understand that the first hour of your program today, you were talking about bathrooms and about how bathrooms are a place where queer bodies are legislated. And bathrooms are at the heart of a certain kind of conversation that happens about queer bodies. My book also begins in a bathroom. It begins in the public toilets beneath Sofia's National Palace of Culture. My narrator is an American living and teaching in Sofia, Bulgaria. And he goes to this bathroom, which is a cruising bathroom, which means it's a place where gay men go to have sex. And he meets there a younger Bulgarian man, and he pays him for sex, which the narrator tells us is the first time he's ever done that. He's never paid anyone before. And I think at the beginning of the book, the narrator imagines that this is going to be a kind of easy or clean transaction, that there's a way in which this is a very clear interaction between two human beings. But one of the things I wanted to write about was I wanted to write about sex work in a way that makes clear, and I think sex work is so complicated and so it's so difficult to say anything about it that is adequate to the complexity of it. But I wanted to write something that makes clear that this is both parties of that transaction remain human beings at every moment of their encounter. And therefore, what the narrator, I think, imagines is going to be this very sort of easy, clear transaction, in fact, because it's a face-to-face encounter between human beings, becomes endlessly complicated. And he finds himself kind of caught by this man and by his feelings for this man in a way that challenges some of the kind of fundamental ideas he has about his life and some of the fundamental defenses he's built around his life.
The narrator, maybe in spite of himself, eventually wants to get Mitko out of the bathrooms, wants to bring him into his sort of his own space, make it, I don't, for lack of a better word, more of a real relationship or something that feels more real, and then almost instantly wrestles with seeing Mitko interacting with other people and feeling that sense of that we all, that anybody would in a relationship when you start to feel a jealousy and, yeah. And a feeling of, you know, wanting to have some kind of connection and possession. And it was complex right away. And so I guess what I want to ask you is, can you relate to us how much of this book, and I think I want to ask both of you this, how much of this book, as a first novel, comes from your own personal stories? You, and I guess you can take us back to 14 years old, and there's some parallels here from what I've understood in previous interviews. Can you take us a little through that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is this, and I'm really interested to hear what Hannah has to say about this as well, because I think her novel really brilliantly plays with a lot of our assumptions about you know, the line between fiction and autobiography and the assumptions that readers make. And that's something that my book is very sort of self-consciously playing with, that line between fiction and autobiography. The narrator doesn't have a name. All of the kind of fact-checkable information we have about the narrator is fact-checkable information that's true about me. He's an American living and teaching high school in Sofia. He's from Kentucky, and the middle section of the book deals with his childhood and coming of age in Kentucky and his relationship with his father. And, you know, the book is fiction. It's not autobiography, and there really is kind of a firewall for me between the work and the life. And the narrator is not me. And, you know, in no way is the book a kind of transcription of quote-unquote reality. But it absolutely does draw from my own experience. I mean, I think the spark of the book came from the fact that I was living in this place that was very strange to me, Bulgaria. I had never been to Eastern Europe when I went. I fell in love with the place. And I found myself having this really vertiginous, weird experience of feeling like, even in this place that was so strange to me, of having moments that absolutely thrust me back into my childhood. I was teaching Bulgarian students at a high school. I was the only openly gay member of my school community. I was the only openly gay person almost any of my students had ever met in real life. And that meant that students who thought they might be LGBT or who knew they were LGBT would come to talk to me about that. And for all of the differences between Bulgaria in 2010 and Kentucky in the early 90s, I felt very much, as they told me their stories, that they were telling me my own story. And the point of contact between these very two different places, which are both places, Kentucky in the 90s and Bulgaria to a very great extent still today, they're places where queer people are taught a single lesson about their lives, which is that their lives lack value and their lives lack dignity, which is exactly the lesson that's taught by laws like North Carolina's quote-unquote bathroom law. These are lessons that queer kids continue to be taught even in the United States, even in the United States in the age of marriage equality, which is that their lives lack value. And I wanted to write something about, you know, what happens. And, you know, my narrator is a man, we don't know his exact age, he's somewhere in his 30s, but we know that he's someone who was raised with these lessons, but who has rejected them. He's someone who for decades has been, you know, immersed in the language and the arguments of LGBT activism and LGBT rights. He knows that the lessons he was taught about his life as a child are bankrupt. And yet he will never get to be someone who was not shaped by those lessons. And so to explore that kind of particular moment of gay subjectivity that we're in right now, where, you know, people are shaped by a shame they have rejected, that seemed to me something I wanted to explore in these books, sort of what it's like in this book, what it's like to grow up in a place where you're taught this lesson about your life, and then how you can recover from it and also how you can't.
So as you say that there is that line, almost that firewall between fiction and autobiography, but the fact-checkable details of the narrator correspond to a lot to you, yeah?
Right.
Did you have any moments where you were almost uncomfortable that it was getting too close?
Well, there were certainly moments where I felt sort of frightened by where the book was taking me. I mean, especially in that middle section, the middle section of the book, which takes place in Kentucky, and which is the section of the book that is most, that cuts closest to my own experience. The whole book is full of invention, including that middle section. But there are moments, especially in the relationship between the narrator and his father, that, you know, did cut very close to the bone. And it was frightening to approach those moments. But to me, you know, the question of the line between fiction and nonfiction, which is, we should remember, a really recent line and has never been a very clear line. Because, you know, the minute you write a narrative, you're engaged in an act of fiction making. Just by selecting where something will begin, where something will end, from the sort of, you know, infinite possible points of data you could pluck to make a narrative, choosing these particular points of data that will create the kind of dramatic arc you want, you're engaged in an act of fiction making. To me, though, there is a big difference between fiction and nonfiction, and it's a difference less of kind of the material that makes up a book and how much of it is invented than it has to do with allegiance. If you write a book and you call it nonfiction, you are declaring an allegiance to a kind of commonly held, you know, visible truth. My book has no such allegiance. Where my book makes use of, quote unquote, of fact-checkable information, it does so not out of any allegiance to the truth, but instead because it was aesthetically useful. It's an entirely opportunistic use of reality. And then it's also where reality was not sort of aesthetically useful, stuff is invented. You know, so sure. There was never a question, even though the book is playing with autobiography, there was never a question to me about whether it was novel or memoir. It was definitely a novel.
Before I turn to Hannah on that same question, one more to you on the subject of, I know you heard a portion of last hour as we talked about laws in this country and what equality means. And you, as you just mentioned, too often LGBTQ youth are taught about lives having value or sort of indicated to them in various ways their lives don't have value. What happened to you at 14?
So, right, when I was 14, my father and stepmother, they opened a letter and in that discovered that I was gay, which was something I had only begun to talk about with my very closest friends. And my father, you know, as happens to, again, even in our age of marriage equality, as happens to very, very many queer kids, you know, my father asked me if this was true. And he said that if it was true, I was not welcome in his house and that I was not his son. And even today, 40% of homeless kids in this country identify as LGBTQ. I could very easily have become one of them. Luckily, I had a mother. My parents separated when I was very young. I had a mother who, even though she had her own long journey when it came to fully accepting the fact that she had a gay kid, it was just a bedrock fact of her life that she loved her son. And so I had a place to go, unlike many, many queer kids. So yeah, you know, I mean, it matters. It matters that the United States remains a place where queer kids are taught this about their lives, where parents, you know, because of course my father had his own education, and where parents are taught that this is something so, you know, monstrous that it, you know, it cuts even that first bond, that, you know, most primary relationship. I mean, we like to tell ourselves a very flattering story about LGBT rights in this country. We like to look at something like Modern Family or think about the fact that a year ago the Supreme Court gave marriage equality, made marriage equality the law of the land. We like to tell ourselves a very flattering story about equality and about, you know, how sort of we've overcome this. But, you know, it remains a case that in the majority of the United States, you can marry your partner on the weekend and be fired from your job and kicked out of your house on Monday for having done so. You know, this is still a country where queer people lack fundamental protections. And, you know, it does sort of make my blood boil a little bit when I sort of hear that flattering narrative we tell ourselves, because there's still so much work to be done. And working with young people, as I did for 7 years as a high school teacher, both in the United States and in Bulgaria, working with young people, I feel really grievously how much damage is still being done all the time by the kinds of narratives that are expressed when laws like HB2 in North Carolina are passed.
I can't even get my head around what a 14-year-old thinks when a father essentially gives an ultimatum. If you are gay, you are not my son. You could lie. You could try to hide it. And that is a choice that no son should ever have to make.
Yeah, and this is a moment that occurs in my novel that is, you know, kind of uniquely transcribed from reality. The conversation that the narrator and his father have is pretty much exactly the conversation I had with my father. And it was clear to me, as it's clear to the narrator in the book, that, you know, what seemed like a choice was not a choice. That if he had denied at that moment who he was, it would have been kind of forfeiting his entire life. And so, you know, there is a way in which he lays claim to himself. I mean, to me, that's the moment, you know, it's the moment in the book that I'm sort of most proud of the narrator, who does a lot of, you know, stupid things in the book. But that moment when he sort of lays claim to his own life. But then, of course, he finds that what he's laying claim to is something that has been really damaged, you know. And so the story of the narrator's life is the story of the life of a lot of queer people in this country, which is sort of, you know, how you take that damage and turn it into something that you can both recover from and then also use, you know, something that you can make useful to yourself in your own life and in the lives of others.
You're hearing the voice of Garth Greenwell, author of What Belongs to You. And Hannah Tennant Moore is the author of Wreck and Order. So you just heard Garth describe in his work of fiction how much of that is drawn from his own experience. Hannah, what was your approach as you wrote Wreck and Order when it came to weaving in your own experience, and how much of that was sort of directly tied to experience? How much of that was invention?
I always feel flattered to have this question. I like for people to believe that the narrator seems like she was taken directly from my life. It's not at all true, but I was interested in creating a kind of truth that can feel, to me, one of the most amazing things about books is to get at a kind of truth that can feel truer than actual real life. Mm-hmm. So our culture is right now obsessed with, we're kind of in this reality craze with reality TV and celebrity memoirs, the whole James Frey debacle. Mm-hmm. And I find that often the details of true lives can be just a distraction from the way it actually feels to be a particular human living through a particular set of experiences. So what I was hoping to look at with Elsie is how it feels to be a young woman who is interested in sex, simply just as an experience, because she's interested in sex, not to get something else from it, which is the case in a lot of memoirs and novels written by women about their sexuality. Paris Hilton described herself as sexy but not sexual. So I wanted to have a narrator who is the opposite, who's sexual but not necessarily sexy, as a way of looking at the difficulties for young women today navigating what is really unprecedented sexual freedom. So it's now perfectly acceptable for women to have as many sexual partners as they want, say. They can talk about their conquests the same as men. But yet we still live in a culture that almost exclusively eroticizes male pleasure and objectifies the female body. I mean, if you watch 5 minutes of internet porn, which I, of course, never have because I'm a serious thinker and reader, but I've heard that it's not exactly empowering to women. So it's a very confusing time, I think, to be a young woman who's interested in exploring her sexuality, because she's getting all these messages that you can do whatever you want, but it's only sexy if you're submissive. And I wanted to look at that that reality in a very specific way. As Garth was talking about, what makes a book is not, or a novel a novel. The difference between nonfiction is that I'm not talking about concepts like feminism and patriarchy in Wreck and Order. Instead, I'm taking a very specific person's life and putting her into very specific situations that have been informed by ideas of feminism and patriarchy today. But it's a way of showing how it feels to live through those particular experiences. So the emotional life of the novel is certainly taken from my own life. Most of Elsie's thoughts and feelings are thoughts and feelings that I've had at various points, but the way that she acts upon them is often invented, or the events that explain her thoughts and feelings is often invented.
So forgive me if I misremember. I think I read an interview where you said Elsie per se is not necessarily a feminist, but it's a feminist book.
That's right. And that's, well, I should say what I mean by feminism.
Sure.
Since it's such a
absolutely,
it's just, yes, a catchphrase, yes, these days. My personal definition of feminism is the belief that men and women are entitled to the same rights and privileges, and also the willingness to act, to take action to support that belief. And so Elsie doesn't do the second part of that definition of feminism. She, her thoughts and her feelings about sex are, they're not conceptual, they're not analytical, they're just feelings. And she usually does not let them dictate her behavior to her own undoing a lot of the time. But Wreck and Order, in describing the pain that results from the kind of sexual experiences that she often invites upon herself, but then finds that she can't dictate the way that they unfold and ends up feeling pretty awful at the end of them. By showing the pain that results from that kind of confusing sexual freedom, I hope that Wreck and Order is a feminist book, even if Elsie is not.
Okay, let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back, spend the rest of the hour with the authors, Hannah Tennant Moore, author of Wreck and Order, Garth Greenwell, author of What Belongs to You, and they are visiting Rochester today. Karen, when we come back, let's do that. Let's do the events, because they're with Writers and Books. It's the Writers and Books debut novel series, and both books are the selection for this fall. So let's get that only break. We'll come back, tell you how you can meet them, and we'll get back into some of their work when we come right back here. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, first hour, some Native American history. Treaty Day is coming up. And if you hear about it every year but you don't know much about what it means, it's your chance to finally learn. That's first hour. Then second hour, are the elections bringing you stress? Are they fraying relationships? Are you feeling like you can't get through the day without a headache because of the national election? We'll talk about how to deal with it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You want to meet Garth and Hannah and hear from them and their books. Karen, why don't you tell us what's coming up here?
Tomorrow at Nazareth College in the Golisano Academic Center, room 38, 1 o'clock, there'll be a reading and a Q&A and book signing, and that is free and open to the public. And then tomorrow night at 7 in the evening at Writers and Books, we will have a slightly longer reading with a Q&A and a more formal discussion of publishing a first novel. And that will be all followed by a reception, and that is $10 for Writers and Books members and $12 for non-members.
Okay, that's coming up here. And you just heard Hannah describing feminism, you know, sort of sex in 2016 and the way sort of male pleasure is still viewed or prioritized in ways that are, I think, female pleasure is not always treated the same way. Look at, and I know you've mentioned this in interviews too, look at movie ratings, things like that. I mean, there's not necessarily equal ground there. But I don't mean this question to be reductive or crude. I just want to ask you both, because our listeners like to get a sense for what may be coming if they pick up the books, What Belongs to You and Wreck and Order. And there's some sex in this book. If you're the kind of person who wants no sex in what you read, probably don't want to pick up these books, but sex is part of life. So, Hannah, was sex an issue for the publication process at all, for your editor, for the publisher?
It's such a fundamental part of the book that nobody who's interested in the book would be squeamish about sexuality. I also treat sex, I hope, in the same way that I treat everything else in the book. So with it was very important to me to have a kind of intelligent, thoughtful approach to sexuality such that it almost makes it impossible to be titillated by it or to find it erotic, because it's – in writing the book, I wanted to give an experience of sex, which we do not have in real life for the most part, in terms – in slowing down time enough to really – be aware of how it feels as a physical, emotional, psychological experience. And having that level of detail, I hope, in the descriptions makes it so that the descriptions of sex in the book are not just, they're not obscene, and they're not, they're doing something more than simply shocking the reader.
Not titillation, utilitarianism. But you say it's not meant to be titillating. It's not there. In other words, I mean, if people say, well, what's the reason that it's there? I think you're understanding exactly what Hannah's saying about why it's there. So, Garth, same kind of question. Did it come up at all? Was it any sort of an issue for editor, publisher, et cetera?
You know, I was warned that it would be. A lot of my friends, especially
you were.
Especially my friends who are gay writers said, you know, if you sell this book to a big publisher, they're going to try to de-gay it. And I remember thinking, well, what in the world would be left, you know? And to my joy, the experience was quite the opposite. You know, I love my editor, in fact, sort of insisted that the scenes be, more explicit, be more dedicated to, you know, actual bodies in space. And, you know, I want to say I was so excited when I saw that, Hannah was going to be here, that I was going to get to have these conversations with Hannah, because I think that our books approach sex maybe in similar ways and with a similar kind of both aesthetic and ethical commitment. I mean, because on one hand, it does seem to me that in our culture at this moment, we are sort of inundated in bodies in a way that's unprecedented. I mean, just, you know, the way eroticized images are everywhere on the internet. You can see absolutely anything you could ever imagine and things you could never have imagined. I mean, there's a way that the sexual body, images of the sexual body are everywhere in our culture, and yet it seems to me there is such a dearth of embodiedness. And by embodiedness, I mean exactly what Hannah was talking about, the idea not just of a body, but of a body that is filled up with a consciousness. The experience of a body is something that, you know, if you look at internet porn, or if you just consider sort of eroticized images of bodies that are all around us, they are images that seem to me to be entirely devoid of a kind of human person, of a sort of a consciousness of, you know, we're surrounded by images of sex that don't in any way communicate the complex emotional and ethical act of communication that sex is. And it does seem to me that literature can do that, and that in writing, you know, these sex scenes in novels, by slowing down time in the way that Hannah was talking about, by concentrating both on bodies and on the minds within bodies, I mean, novels add something to our cultural ideas of sex that I think is really essential, which is the fact that, you know, sex is an act of communication. And the fact that, you know, sex, it seems to me, is a kind of crucible of humanness. I mean, it's a place where so many things are put under so much pressure psychologically in terms of physical sensation, that it, to me, is a sort of tool for the novelist that's more useful than almost any other tool in terms of exploring character, exploring relationship. And I mean, it does seem to me that, thinking of titillation, I mean, I do think art can titillate. I think that, you know, arousal is a legitimate response to a work of art. And yet, I also think there's a clear line between art and pornography. And it's kind of the same line as between art and propaganda. Art can have ethical and political commitments. But pornography and propaganda both intend to elicit a singular response from the reader, to make the reader feel, or the audience, to make the audience feel a single thing. And I think art is made out of contrary feelings, out of ambivalence, out of contrary desires. And so art, I think, always demands a more complicated response. And that's the difference, not a level of explicitness, not a level even of obscenity, but instead the work that sex is doing in a book is what differentiates it, I think, from, you know, pornography.
That's so much I want to respond to. To start, just thank you for clarifying the idea that it's fine to have eroticism be part of a novel. But to me, if there's an erotic response in the reader, that's incidental. That's not ever the purpose behind a sexual passage in Wreck and Order. I think also as a female writer, I feel obligated to really distance myself from the idea of writing a, quote, sexy book, because I'm then immediately seen as a certain kind of writer.
Right. Which, I mean, that's something I feel as well as a queer writer. And it's also something that sort of makes me, you know, redouble my commitment to writing sex and to writing the queer sexual body. Because again, I mean, even in our moment of sort of marriage equality, I think it remains the fact in this country that the queer body and especially the queer sexual body is despised. You know, I think that's something that was made very clear. I mean, I think it's something that's made clear, very clear, even in things like Modern Family, you know, which is on one hand a sort of wonderful celebration of the value of queer lives and queer families. On the other hand, it's pretty much impossible for me to imagine those two men having sex. And I think a lot of the public acceptance that has been gained for queer people in this country, especially through the marriage equality movement, has come at the cost of sort of making sure that people don't think about queer bodies and especially gay male bodies having sex. I don't think it's an accident that, you know, the worst mass shooting in this country of mass shootings targeted queer bodies and queer bodies of color in an eroticized space. And so, you know, it does seem to me that one reason I want to write the queer sexual body is because when you make art about out of a thing, you're making a claim about it. You're making a claim about its value. And so to write the queer sexual body in a way that makes use, I hope, of sort of all of the lyrical resources of the English literary tradition that makes that moment a sort of repository for beauty. I hope that is a way of declaring the value, not arguing for the value of queer bodies, but declaring their value as a fact. And also, I hope it's a way to cherish those bodies. I mean, to sort of a way to kind of care for those bodies. And it's a way, I mean, for me as a writer, it feels like one of the ways that I can usefully push back against what remains a culture that despises the queer body.
In terms of novels being uniquely suited towards kind of filling in the image, the imagery that we're used to, we're kind of inundated with of sex. And we see a lot of images of what, say, a blowjob is or what intercourse is. And so I think people now have these kind of flashes of imagery. It was such a relief for me in reading your book that you do, as you say, use the English language in order to fill in the image and make it a full experience. I will say I don't think all writers who treat sex today necessarily are doing with the same level of care that I see in your book. For instance, we just have to mention 50 Shades of Grey if we're talking about writing and sex. The narrator, I only read a little bit of the book, so I can't speak to the whole thing. The first time she has an orgasm is from having her nipples briefly licked. I don't know if that's ever happened to a woman, but God bless you if it has. My experience of sex is that it's purely a fantasy, which is fine. And there's certainly there's a place for writing about sex. It's just for fantasy. But I think that what your book does so beautifully and what I hope Wreck and Order does to some extent is to treat sex the way it actually feels to be inside that body. That's and inside right. that mind and heart as it's unfolding.
Well, and, you know, I mean, the thing that I find pretty toxic about something like 50 Shades of Grey is that I think, you know, a book like that, I mean, it doesn't, I don't think it makes any use really of kind of the potential of literature as, you know, a technology for communicating consciousness. Instead, what it does is it just, to me, it just flatters the most toxic fantasies we have about straight male desire in our culture and about
Absolutely.
Female submissiveness in our culture. And I'll say, I mean, something I think is so brilliant about Wreck and Order is that, you know, it takes some of those tropes about female submissiveness and about a certain kind of male desire, and it absolutely just hollows them out and turns them on their head. And that's why, I mean, to me, it's such a sort of powerful book about female desire. I mean, precisely because it's willing to go to that territory and sort of strip away the fantasy from it and look at it as a reality. I think it's really brilliant.
Thank you.
Down to our last 2 minutes, let me just ask you both here. With the success of your debut novels, and we think Writers and Books debut novel series is the pinnacle, but there may be others. Hannah, what's next for you? in the publishing world?
I've been working on my second novel for actually a couple of years now. It takes so long before mm-hmm. your book actually comes out. So that's where my mind is right now, is just my second book.
Okay, Garth?
Yeah, and you know, as Hannah was saying earlier, publishing a book is exactly the opposite of writing a book.
Yeah.
And, you know, since January, I have been traveling and speaking publicly about the book and have not been writing. And so I feel really desperate to get back to that space of kind of privacy and inwardness where you can make art.
Did you need this in some ways in the early days of sort of the travel and the promotion? Was this some sort of a nice break, and are you now ready to dive back in, or has this been a grind from the beginning?
Well, you know, I mean, it's both things at once. I mean, it still seems to me like a miracle to meet someone who has read my book. I mean, absolutely, it's a miracle every time. And at the same time, it is, you know, I mean, you choose to be a writer because you like to be in a room by yourself and, you know, and probably you're not super comfortable talking to strangers. And so, you know, that part of it remains hard. Yeah.
You're not comfortable talking to, you know, people can hear you right now.
Are we on the air?
You are. In fact, this whole hour has been, you can meet both of them. And I think what you're hearing this hour is exactly why Writers and Books wanted them here. Garth Greenwell is the author of What Belongs to You. Hannah Tennant Moore, author of Wreck and Order. And you can meet them, Writers and Books, and at Nazareth College, the event tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Is that right, Karen?
1 o'clock at Nazareth College in the Galassano Center, Academic Center, room 38, and that is free. And then tomorrow night at Writers and Books at 7, a little extended conversation. We'll get to meet the authors there, too.
And by the way, if you don't know the NAS community, just say you're going to the GAC, the Galassano GAC. Academic Center. It's the main building mm-hmm. on campus, easy to find. A great setting. They've had other authors there. Thank you, Karen. Thanks for being here. Thanks for bringing
Thank
them
you.
Here. Garth Greenwell, our pleasure. Nice meeting you.
Thanks
you
so much
here.
For having me.
And Hannah Tennant Moore, author of Wreck and Order, our pleasure as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you Friday on member-supported public radio.